Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Daniel Paris, host of New Books in Finance, a channel of the New Books Network. I'm delighted today to have Professor Shanette Garrett-Scott with me, author of the new book, Banking on Freedom, Black Women in U.S. Finance Before the New Deal. The book was just published by Columbia University Press. Professor Garrett-Scott, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Daniel, for having me.
So your book is just awfully interesting on so many levels. And before we get into it, I really wanted to highlight, which for me was one of the most interesting parts in the background, which is in the beginning of the book, as you set the stage for the main tale to come, there's a lot of material on informal societies and self-help societies and burial societies. So, you know, for the modern readers in finance, in which you have a lot of large organizations that are kind of national or even global in nature, I think it's incredibly helpful to remind people that before this kind of modern age, so much of finance and banking and insurance and burial societies was done locally. Can you kind of, you know, reintroduce us as to how that, you know, those informal societies, what that was like?
So these informal societies, these mutual aid societies were very important in global capitalism. So they come, of course, from British friendly societies. And when and settlers came over to the New World, they brought those organizations with them. Africans, too, when they were brought over from Africa to serve as an enslaved labor, they also were bringing with them a tradition of self-help and mutual aid, credit, governing societies. And their experiences in the Americas forced them to kind of blend these European secret societies with the African secret societies. And it's really important to note that even enslaved people relied on their own resources, especially to assure a burial for themselves. But they also would save money as a way to buy freedom and also to make their lives in slavery a little bit easier. So I think that's important. Well, it's important to note that it was a blending of the tradition from Europe and America and Africa as well. But it again really shows how the African-American experience in business is interwoven in the development of capitalism in the United States. It's not a separate story, but one that is really intimately connected. So these societies, as I said, were really important, especially for ensuring burials and providing a place for African Americans to save money and extend credit to each other. And they serve the exact same purpose also for immigrants, for other, you know, Anglo-Americans in the early part of the U.S. history.
Yeah, my as I did some family history, my forebears came from Eastern Europe and Russia. And they, I know that my great-grandfather is buried in the Minsk Burial Association lot in a cemetery in the Bronx in New York, and they all belonged to that cemetery society and paid for their plot beforehand so that when they passed, the community, they had, you know, prepared that, but it was an association. And I know that association also provided other services to the members, but it started as a burial association.
Right, exactly. Especially as, particularly with immigrants, as, you know, more and more immigrants come to the United States. And then, of course, with African Americans after the Civil War and emancipation, they take these societies and transform them, saving some elements, say, of like the conviviality, meeting together, the kind of civic features of those, and they really try to graft them onto the new economic challenges that they are facing. And of course, that happens as well in mainstream U.S. society. So you have societies like these societies that become these major companies like Prudential and MetLife and others.
And so then we take it up a notch from a local burial society to these more formal organizations. And in the one that you follow is an outgrowth of the Order of St. Luke, and it has various permutations, which, you know, sets the stage. So they become, you know, more than just a local community. They really become much more complex. And of course, it's important to note that in the case of the St. Luke Society, the headwinds that this organization faced were just massive headwinds because of prejudice against the members, but that nevertheless, a more formal, wide-ranging, multi-office, multi-city self-help association, the Order of St. Luke, emerges and creates the basis for the creation of the bank later. But, you know, that is just a fascinating tale as to what the Order of St. Luke did. Do you want to provide some of that tale?
I guess so. The Independent Order of St. Luke was first started in 1856 by a free Black woman in Baltimore. Of course, after the war, she sees an opportunity to extend these services to these large populations of newly freed African Americans. So, and she is not the only one. There are thousands of these organizations that make the transition from slavery to freedom. But the Independent Order of St. Luke, I think, is in particular of unique because it Prout, when she started the organization in 1856, really imagined it as an organization for women by women. There were men who were connected with the Independent Order of St. Luke, but by and large, especially as it grows in the 20th century, it is really controlled by an important cadre of Black women. And so the headwinds that they face have to do with juggling the kind of double burden of racism, but sexism, right, as
and again,
well.
Just mention the name, because just so it's clear, because there are two women who emerge. The first one is Mary Ann Prout, Prout, and she's in the first stage here with the orders. The real heroine shows up next, but as you point out, they are facing a double burden of finance and services as both women and as a Black minority in after the Civil War, but struggling against the continued challenges. But to make it a formal multi-city organization providing a variety of services, leaving a church and going outside of just the church confines into regular non-church civil society is a difficult challenge.
Yes, it was a difficult challenge. Part of the challenge early on was just convincing many African Americans that they needed insurance, because these societies had to extend beyond just providing burial services, but they also now you have these working adults and children, working women in particular, who need some protections in the event that they're sick, And they need money to make ends meet, and then also to ensure their lives. And then also because of racism, because of segregation, many of these societies get the idea to pool these small resources, the nickels and the dimes, together to create businesses and services that serve these growing African-American communities. So the Independent Order of St. Luke is not unique, but they are important, I think, in that not only do they, of course, form a bank, but they also run a store, a newspaper, as well as their insurance arm. So these, you're right. So as these organizations kind of leave their little parochial city focus and become these national network of councils and state organizations, this increases the bureaucracy, but it also increases the wealth and brings a lot of attention to them. On the one part, on the one hand, as these symbols of what African Americans can do, despite the restrictions of Jim Crow and racism, and for women too, despite the kinds of negative stereotypes and connotations about African-American women's sexuality, their intellect, the limited opportunities that they face in a segmented marketplace. The Independent Order of St. Luke emerges as a symbol of African-American success. And of course, with that symbol, because that you have Black pride, but it also in some ways becomes targeted. By regulated.
Yeah, and I saw that the more complicated the financial activities became, the greater the pressure from either competitors or regulators acting aggressively as regulators, so that the more successful the venture became, the harder the venture became.
Yes. And so this story, I think, is also really important to highlight the links between kind of extra legal violence that we, as we understand the history of, you know, African Americans and their experience, we of course learn about lynching and that kind of mob and extra legal violence. But when you are operating these really complex financial institutions, on the one hand, they do, you know, suffer some threats of that kind of, you know, racial sexual violence, but they also become really vulnerable to
strict
regulations.
Yeah, the state regulators.
Yes, a pressure from local merchants who try to push them out as competitors. They face a lot of red tape, limitations on their access to capital. So these things that perhaps on the other contexts would be seen as some of the kind of downsides or darker sides of competition really become a kind of other kind of violence or aggression against these particular kinds of organizations.
Nevertheless, the IOSL continued, developed, grew, splintered. I know there were, you know, various organizations, various divisions and so forth. And then we get to sort of the main part of your story, which is, if you know, both the high point of this type of enterprise, including the high point of the opposition, is the creation of a state chartered official bank. And that's what happens next with both all of the resistance and the success of it. And really the tale, Banking on Freedom, is the tale of Maggie Lena Walker, who you'll introduce in a second, and the St. Luke's Bank as the height of this effort, and also the height of the challenges that this effort of self-financing community faced. Could you just share some of the history of the founding of the St. Luke Bank?
Yes. So when Maggie Lena Walker emerges as the leader, the Grand Secretary Treasurer of the Independent Order of St. Luke around the turn of the 20th century, and she puts forth a bold economic
and this is just
vision.
Just to clarify, because that is at this point, if not a national, but a regional organization, but she is in the Richmond Yes. Richmond, correct. So she's the head of the Richmond organization.
Yes, she. Well, the headquarters is in Richmond. The headquarters is switched, has basically shifted from Baltimore to Richmond with the splintering that you talked mm-hmm. about and the development and the growth of the organization. But it almost dies out. Toward the end of the century, end of the century, but Magdalena Walker comes on board, and she has a bold economic vision to make the order even more powerful, to extend it even further across the America, to provide more services. And one of, for her, the essential service is not just the insurance, but banking. She wants to be able to help capitalize African-American business, but also to grow Black wealth, especially in the era in the area of home ownership. And what's really fascinating and unique about the St. Luke Bank is it is the first bank that is founded, organized, and led by African-American women. So Magdalena Walker is the president, but the main shareholders in the bank, The main people who buy stock and build up this bank are working class African American women, washerwomen, factory workers, but also some middle class African American women. So most of the people who buy stock and get the bank started are African American women.
And this, the book has, your account has an interesting story that actually chartering a bank isn't easy. Raising the capital for a bank isn't easy. And then when you're trying to raise capital from a bank from many small investors, it's not easy. And you know, some sort of said they were, there was a kind of a discount to, hey, please help charter the bank. You need to put in $20. We'll take $5 now, pay the $15 later. And the $15 was awfully hard to come by. And you know, it was a real struggle just to keep the base operation going.
Yeah. So Walker has this vision, but she does run up against the reality that, as you said, that these many of these working women are low paid, poorly paid. But she becomes creative in her ideas about how to finance the bank. So she does begin to offer kind of a loan or installment plan to pay for stock. She also seeks kind of collective or cooperative stock purchases by seeking other small local Independent Order of St. Luke councils and other fraternal societies to kind of maybe pool money together to buy larger blocks of stock. But she of course travels all around the country, and she begins promising in places like New York and along the East Coast, especially. She's telling people about this wonderful bank, you know, created by African American women, but this is an opportunity for African Americans to invest in each other. And she tries to encourage loans and draw business from around the country.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And she, you know, she basically succeeds. The bank takes deposits. The bank provides mortgages. In your tale, much of the day is spent fighting for survival, but when they're not fighting for survival, that 10 minutes a day when they're not fighting for their very survival, they're actually in the normal business of a bank. And, you know, mortgages were provided, mortgages were paid off, maybe not as much as, you know, National City Bank at the time, but it did meet the standards of what we would understand as a deposit-taking mortgage lending bank.
Yes, it did. And so it operated, of course, as a bank, but given the kind of unique situation with as African-American women, in many ways, she often had to accommodate the racism and sexism, but also find ways to subvert it. So one of the really most important ways was through providing these loans to buy homes. So of course, she's on the one hand limited in where African Americans are able to purchase these properties, but she still encourages home ownership. And once she, especially as Black women, owning their own homes, she is then able to encourage them to pay their poll taxes, to be active in local civic affairs, and to continue to, you know, to strengthen and anchor African-American communities. So you begin to see in several other cities, these kind of small, you know, Black Wall Streets, these enclaves of African-American owned businesses, people own their own homes, and they're these really vital, though segregated, but these really vital, vibrant places where people are really, actively engaged in not just consumption and capitalism, but also culture and activism and politics and consciousness building and consciousness raising. So these banks are just such an essential part of African Americans. You know, freedom dreams, their ideas about what it means to be citizens in a country that has so many restrictions and barriers in their wake. But they really illustrate the drive and the ambition that drives so many other Americans towards success. And these are really great stories of people, you know, really acting under very adverse circumstances and with limited opportunities and limited resources, really making something that is important. And as you say, not as big as what becomes Bank of America or even some of the banks in these local places, but they are still no less important to these, just these communities, but as symbols and inspiration for other places around the country.
And so and it's worth pointing out just the time frame so that people understand. The bank was founded in 1903, and the prime of the bank is from 1903 until the crash and the rise and fall of the bank. Unfortunately, there is a fall of the bank, but you know, its prime time was for a couple decades before the crash. It's worth your book is academic and it cites a lot of information. It seems that there is other, you know, you're not the first person to discover Magdalena Walker, but she is a force of nature and is worth probably 10 books. I don't know. Are there other accounts of her? Is she as well known as she probably ought to be? And again, I apologize. I am not a U.S. historian, and therefore, if I don't know the answer to that, I apologize. But she seems worth several books on her own.
Yes, there is a biography of her by Gertrude Marlowe, who was published. She's an anthropologist, and she mm-hmm. really looks at Walker and the Independent Order of St. Luke. It is a wonderful book. It has a lot of really rich details and information about her life and her activism and her community involvement. And then Elsa Barkley Brown has written a number of really important articles about her, say for the OAH, the Organization of American Historians magazine, as well as a really famous article, which talks about, you know, her and feminism raising kind of feminist consciousness. And they, of course, acknowledge her great business acumen. But I do think that my book is the first book to really look
focus
at
on the business part.
Yeah, to focus on the business aspect, how she raised money. They invested and spent money, collected debts, provided opportunities, worked inside the bank. So I think that it's important for that. And of course, in Richmond and in the southeastern part of the country, she is well known in Richmond. There are high schools named for her. Very recently, last year, I think it's last year, a monument was erected, a public memorial to her. So and the National Park Service, of course, has a house, the Magdalena Walker House in Richmond, that gets millions of visitors. So you're able to actually see her home and learn more about her and see the community in which she lived.
So she's doing well 100 years later. Was she that well regarded at the time, or is it really 100 years later that she is being elevated to the status? I mean, was she viewed as path-breaking and a force of nature at the time, or is that really a creation of the historians? I just out of curiosity.
Yeah, unfortunately, we do have a lot of stories of people who don't get their due when they were living. But Magdalena Walker was seen as an incredible woman at the time. And I talk about in the book how I think that sometimes for her, it became a burden to be seen as like the woman in finance, the African-American woman in finance. So often she would be the only woman among these bankers and financiers who saw themselves as plotting the economic future of African-Americans. So on the one hand, she enjoyed a large popularity around the country and was very well known as this kind of novelty of the only Black woman bank president. But she did spend much of her life, her goal really was to bring more women into the finance industry. So the Independent Order of St. Luke and St. Luke Bank are really important because they were the largest employer of white collar or corporate, African American women in the 19 teens and the 1920s.
Well, again, hopefully there's even more to come on her because she does seem like such an interesting character. A good part of your book, now that the bank is established, a good part of your book deals with the fascinating operating culture of the book, of small scale lending, of lending in an incredibly hostile environment, of the regulators and competitors. So on one hand, fighting to survive against the state banking regulator or the state insurance regulator, the downtown merchants, as you mentioned. On the other hand, working, client by client, the culture inside the bank, the women inside the bank. It's a nice and fascinating account of what this bank was like on the inside. There are many, many stories to tell, but, perhaps share just a few that entice the readers.
I think I would perhaps share two. So the fact that people tend to really focus on Magdalena Walker, they forget that she didn't run this bank all on her own, that she depended on other African-American women. And so we don't always get to see or pay attention to the women that are around her. And I do talk about in the last chapter, this kind of generational conflict that
right.
comes
she,
up.
She, with, her main assistant and
yes.
her as coming up, they, as is often the case, they have a bit of a falling out.
Yes. So you have a generation of women who were born in slavery, who worked to create these opportunities, who are now hiring and working side by side with a generation of young women who were never enslaved and who have been the beneficiaries of the kinds of opportunities that these other women created. And they chafe under some of the restrictions. They don't want to do prayer every day. They want to wear the latest fashions and not what's known as kind of the St. Luke uniform, the crisp white shirtwaist and the long, dark, nondescript skirt. This is the roaring 20s, especially when this is going on. So you and these women want to be able to listen to jazz and not just have to listen to scriptures. So she does, in particular, this is really kind of encapsulated when she butts heads with another incredibly talented, ambitious, younger woman, Lelia Bankett, who doesn't quite want to bend, you know, to Walker's vision of her. So the book does talk about that. And then the book also tries to go beyond the St. Luke Bank to really look at the ways in which this, especially in the 1920s before the crash, there is a culture of African-American, I guess, venture capital. Basically, you have these warring, you know, Black finance companies who are all vying for the dollars of these working class African Americans. So the 1920s are roaring not just for, Anglo Americans, but African Americans too. They're interested in investing in stocks and as a way to achieve a kind of commercial emancipation. They're interested in growing their wealth and, you know, get rich quick schemes. I do have what I think is a pretty interesting and really relatively unknown discussion about the kind of contests for the pocketbooks, as well as the hearts and minds of women, of young women and men in the 20s, right, you know, in this right before the market, of course, falls out.
So this is where my story begins to emerge. I'm, you know, interested in the history of the stock market. And indeed, the 20s were a roaring challenge, and the expansion of the numbers of people investing in stocks ultimately worked out poorly, but it was indeed the roaring 20s in the sense of more and more people getting involved in finance for better or for worse, more and more people getting involved with the stock market for better or for worse. And what your work does is nicely explain how that works in a minority community that is facing so many difficulties or challenges in getting involved in that. But nevertheless, they did, you know, the outlines of modern finance you can see in the African-American community in the 1920s, as you can see it elsewhere. And you can also see it getting too heated, too frothy. And it does lead, you know, we do have the crash. After the stock market crash and then the depression, a lot of banks closed. Ultimately, the St. Luke's Bank fails along with many others and is absorbed in several other bank acquisitions. And at that point, Maggie Lena Walker is of a certain age where it's really past her time to be able to fix that or change that or start all over again. Is that a fair assertion?
Well, actually, the bank survives. It's one of the very few banks to survive past the Great Depression. I know my book ends around the crash when the banks merge. But I do just really quickly want to go back to say something about the roaring 20s before I talk about the bank merger is to talk. So the African Americans are, you know, butting up against some limitations, but they are also creating their own kinds of definitions and ways of participating in the market. And one of the most important is for them is to try to mitigate or talk about investing in African-American business as almost, you know, risk-free. And part of the way that they do that is convincing people that they are doing something to advance or uplift the race, uplift the race. So African-Americans, you know, are not, I mean, now we may look back and think how foolish of them to have, you know, bought on the margins and not seen the weaknesses of these companies or these appeals for capital. But they were thinking strategically and feeling that by uplifting the race collectively, that in a way kind of mitigated risk. But of course, Maggie Lena Walker, always an astute businesswoman, and she is nearing the end of her life. She passes away in 1934. But in the very late 20s, she begins to notice the St. Luke's Bank's profits are dipping a little. But of course, she has a weather eye on other African-American banks in the community. Richmond is really unique in that it has a number of African-American-owned banks, more than any other city. So she sees that the other banks, other African-American banks that are operating are really suffering. And so she approaches those bank presidents, and for their collective survival, she proposes a merger. So in 1929, she does merge with one bank. And then the commercial bank and trust, they decide, oh, we're going to try to see if we can weather it. So in 1929, when she merges with one African-American owned bank, the bank changes its name. It becomes the Consolidated Bank and Trust. I guess she's going with the idea that she consolidated these two banks. Of course, by 1931, the early 30s, depression has hit. The commercial bank and trust decides, yes, we need to go ahead and consolidate. So basically, Consolidated Bank and Trust becomes three Black-owned banks. But the St. Luke Bank is by far the strongest of the partners. She merged as a way to protect the other banks from failure more than protect the St. Luke. And then Consolidated becomes the longest-running Black-controlled bank up until 2011. So it does have a life of more than 100 years when, of course, it is finally, succumbs to the subprime mortgage kind of crisis and closes and is absorbed along with some other banks in today what is known as Premier Bank, which operates in Richmond.
And is Premier, we talked about the kind of the revival of Maggie Lena Walker, is Premier Bank participating in that? Or does she loom large in their archives, or are they unaware of the history?
I think everyone in Richmond is really aware of the history. And I can say for Premier, I can't really answer that question. I'm not for sure. But I can say that when the bank, was just crippled beyond any saving, in 2011, at least the people who purchased the bank had the foresight to know that those bank records were important. And they and so there were people who helped bridge, had been part of Consolidated, who were now executives who were brought over, in Premier. And they did help shepherd those records over to Virginia Union University. So, which if
rather than
not,
just destroying them,
no way, exactly. Yeah. There is no way I could have done this book without those records. It's still a fragmented record. Everything is not there, but it is still a really rich record. And those records go up to, it has really rich records up until like the 40s and the 50s. So anyone who's really interested in trying to see how this bank Consolidated kind of merges in this new kind of financial era, especially post-war.
Did Consolidated operate after the war, primarily serving the African-American community, or did it become a more generic bank?
No, it was always Black controlled. So women, it wasn't necessarily women controlled, but it always had branches. It had different branches that operated in African-American communities. African-Americans were its primary customer base, but of course they welcomed all depositors. But overwhelmingly, most of the lending that they did was to Black churches, Black businesses, and in Black areas of town. Though they did, have a portfolio that included the municipal clients and other say white owned or non-Black owned businesses and opportunities, but it always sustained its commitment to the African American community.
Well, it's a fascinating story, Professor Garrett Scott. The book is Banking on Freedom: Black Women in U.S. Finance Before the New Deal. Came out earlier this year from Columbia University Press. I encourage our listeners to get a copy. You've heard a few of the stories, but really, there are really, really interesting stories on pretty much every page. Professor Garrett Scott, I wanted to ask you, often the case with the academic authors, give you an opportunity, if you have recovered from writing and publishing this book, what your next what your next project is, what you're working on, or are you still in the taking a break after having produced this very interesting work?
No, as I think most people know, as you're doing one project, there are always these things that are calling you that capture your attention. So my work focuses on race, gender, and capitalism. So my new project, which I'm really excited about to really be able to really devote a lot more time to, is looking at peonage, so modern day slavery. So it's looking at hundreds of African American peons who were basically enslaved on this island in the Deep South, and they were forced to, to make bootleg liquor, and it has.
Is this during the 1920s?
1920s during Prohibition. Okay. So it has gangsters. It has, GIs, the spies.
And where is this island?
It's in the middle of the Mississippi River.
Okay.
I think it's going to be such a fascinating story, but I have a lot of information, but I really want to try to capture the experiences of the African Americans. But it was reputed, by the government that this island, I call it Horror Island, that this island supplied, two thirds of the bootleg liquor, in the Deep South. So this is a way for me to just kind of look at informal economy.
Sure.
And it's kind of the dark side, I think, of capitalism.
Well, there are a number of those. So you have a choice. Thank you so much again. The book is Banking on Freedom. Professor Shanette Garrett-Scott, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. And I look forward to discussing your next project when it's out.
Thank you.